I was 18, and I saw a poster advertising a free public lecture in Transcendental Meditation, and I went, I did the course, and I loved it, and I've been meditating ever since.
Jeff Gilpin was one of the hundreds of thousands of young people who got caught up in the Transcendental Meditation movement in the early 1970s. Its charismatic guru, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, made meditation practically a household word. Gilpin not only joined the movement, he went the whole nine yards, including spending 5 years as a student at Maharishi International University in Fairfield, Iowa. Recently, he went back, packed his car, and took off for Iowa to find out what became of the movement that once meant so much to him. In his new book, The Maharishi Effect, he describes what he found. And Strange Chimps asked Jeff Gilpin why he fell in love with TM in the first place.
What was the very first time you tried meditation like?
Well, the lecture itself wasn't all that impressive to me personally. Maharishi at the time was emphasizing very practical things, health benefits like reduced rate of heart attacks and high blood pressure and so forth. And I was 18, and those sort of things really didn't appeal to me. I wanted enlightenment. I wanted cosmic consciousness. But back then, TM was really the only game in town. If you wanted meditation instruction, you went to Maharishi. But I remember the morning that I learned, and I had this experience of wonderful inner clarity and peace. And I remember coming outside and looking up and seeing the clouds and the blue sky so clear as if I'd never seen them before. And it was just wonderful.
Hmm. Once you learned the basic technique of meditation, what was it that pulled you even further into the movement? What was so attractive about it at the time?
Well, for one thing, it was such a great social scene. Many groups go through a process of evolution where in the early days, it's all new, it's all fun, it's like a big party. You're part of a family, you have an identity. You have a mission to transform the world, and it's just great. And of course, that was very tied up with the atmosphere back in the 60s and 70s. You know, a lot of people in the TM movement came out of the counterculture, and we maybe realized that revolution wasn't going to occur through street demonstrations or through LSD. And we realized that there was hope for something else, a revolution in consciousness.
As you spent time in the Maharishi's movement, did you become enlightened? Did your consciousness continue to evolve?
Certainly. Maharishi has an analogy that I really like. He says that before you start meditating, it's like you're looking through a very narrow angle lens at, say, a mountain range. You see a little bit of a peak here and a few trees here and there. But as you meditate, you broaden your lens. You zoom out where you see the whole mountain range. He also says that you feel more at home. You feel more like yourself. There were a number of other aspects to the TM movement that I wasn't comfortable with. The conformity. A lot of people in the movement adopt a sort of in-speak that's part Sanskrit, part New Age language. And over the years, I saw that becoming, I think, more rigid. I saw the movement becoming more authoritarian, more hierarchical, and I really wasn't comfortable with that. Mm. So when the time for me came to move on, I just got on with my life and said goodbye, and that was it.
At its higher reaches, people who were close to the Maharishi and people who'd been practicing TM for a while began to make claims that seemed somewhat incredible. Claims that if you kept on, you could eventually learn to levitate, for instance, yogic flying.
Yeah. Well, that was something that was just beginning to appear in the world of the TM movement about the time that I left. I think what happened is that people in the movement had been meditating for a long time. Maharishi said that you would become enlightened, you would attain cosmic consciousness in 5 to 8 years. And in the late 70s, a lot of people had been doing it for 5 to 8 years, and a lot of people were wondering, well, okay, what happens next? My guess is that Maharishi was under a certain amount of pressure to come up with something to keep the crowds happy, and In the late 70s, he came up with new meditation techniques, which are technically known as the siddhis or yogic powers. And the most famous one is yogic flying. Supposedly, if you learn this technique, you can lift off and levitate and fly like Superman. I was there on the campus of Maharishi University in the late 70s when the first group of yogic flyers came back from Maharishi's headquarters in Switzerland at the time. And they were doing the flying technique in my dorm in a lounge that they had closed off. They put sheets over the windows and they had guards at the door to keep everybody out because this was top secret. And I heard them doing something down there. And I snuck down the stairs and I peeked in. And it was a bunch of guys sitting in the lotus position on foam mats, bouncing up and down on their rear ends and yelling their heads off. And it wasn't very dignified, and they certainly weren't flying. To me, it was just more evidence that the movement was moving in a direction that I really wasn't interested in.
Hmm. Now, you, as you said, moved on, mm-hmm. got on with your life, stayed a serious meditator. That's been mm-hmm. part of your life for a long time.
Definitely.
What made you, though, decide to turn around, go back, and take a closer look at what had happened to the Maharishi's movement?
Well, it was one particular event. It was in 1999, I got a mailing from the movement, a flyer with a very scary warning on it. The headline on this brochure was Maharishi's Final Warning to the United States. And he said that the only hope is if the governments of the world turn to Maharishi and implement his programs. And to me, the tone of this brochure was alarming. Back in my day, Maharishi was always very kind of jovial. You know, his nickname was the Giggling Guru. He was always very positive and laughing and telling jokes. And now suddenly here he is warning about the end of the world, like some apocalyptic street corner preacher. And frankly, I had visions of another Jonestown. I was really worried that something was going on in the movement that would lead to a bad end, and I wanted to find out for myself.
What are the main changes that you discovered?
The movement itself is now not the grassroots organization it was in my day. It is, frankly, a theocracy. Maharishi, a few years ago, crowned one of his followers as a god king, who is supposedly the king of us all, the sovereign of the whole world, and everyone in the movement now is a subject of Maharishi and his god king. There's a court of rajas of Maharishi's followers who administer basically all of the world. In Wisconsin, there is a raja, I believe in Chicago. We're part of his dominion. The I know.
Even those of us who don't recognize his authority or know he exists, we're still part of his dominion?
You weren't aware that you're part of a global theocracy run by Maharishi. That's a huge change. And if something like that had been going on in my day, I would have just turned and run in the opposite direction. So that's a huge change. Another thing is, I think, that the emphasis on fundraising. Whatever spiritual element there is in the movement, whatever meditation, whatever else there is, has, I think, become secondary to fundraising. For instance, the rajas. If you want to be a raja, you take a raja training course, and the price for this ranges between $500,000 and $1 million.
But you mean you can basically buy rajahood? It's not simply conferred on you because of your advanced spiritual powers?
Well, as I see it, the size of your bank account in the TM movement is also an indication of your spiritual development.
What about the Maharishi himself? Mm-hmm. Were you able to find out anything about him? And how did he go from being this jovial, giggling guru to somebody who warns about the end of the world?
Yeah, well, that's a fascinating story. And it's really a difficult story to say because he's been a recluse now for many, many years. He lives in a compound in the Netherlands, surrounded by a small staff, by his king and his rajas, basically, who I assume, tell him what he wants to hear.
He must be a very old man by
now. He's very, very old. He's in his 90s. He does occasionally appear on the Maharishi Channel, his satellite TV network. He gets up and talks, and apparently he's had any number of health problems over the years, but, you know, for a guy in his mid-90s, I think he seems like he's doing okay.
Are there any particular lessons you've taken away from the investigation you did of mm-hmm. the movement and what had happened to it? You know, as you take that wide-angle, long view of the movement, what conclusions have you come to?
My motto is keep your crap detector turned up on high. If you join a group, if you become interested in a guru, if you want to follow a particular teaching, the spiritual journey can be a very valuable, enriching thing. It is very, very easy to fall into gullibility and superstition. And I think especially in a case where we assume that a leader is more than human, to me that's just fraught with peril. And if you see an organization where the leader is referred to as God or appears to have some kind of divine authority, that's I think, a real red flag. It's true that on the spiritual path, you are, by definition, embracing irrationality. Irrationality is part of the human mind, part of the human psyche. We can't get rid of it. It's there. So is critical reason. So is rationality. So is skepticism. If you abandon those things just because you're on a spiritual path, you are giving up a good part of what it means to be a human being.
Well said. What role does TM still play in your life today?
Well, I still do it. I still meditate twice a day, morning and evening, for 20 minutes, and it cost me $35 to learn how to do that back in 1973, and I think I got my money's worth.
Jeff Gilpin tells the story of his years in the TM movement in a book called The Maharishi Effect. Anne Strangechamp spoke with him.